Well, welcome again to Wednesday night. It is great to see you all here. I'm so glad that you're here. We are in our third week of a series on risk, and we've been talking about this the last couple of weeks, and tonight, really because over the last couple of years, I have come to be absolutely convinced that the one thing that matters more than anything else in our growth in following Jesus Christ is whether or not we're willing to take risks. It's all about the willingness to take a risk. And so over the last couple of weeks, we've talked about some ways that we can take risks. And tonight we're going to talk about an amazing story in the Bible where some guys take the biggest risk in life that you can possibly take. And it's amazing, the story. But before we get there, I want to tell you a little bit of a story of a moment where I took a risk for myself. And it wasn't anywhere near as big of a risk as what they took. As a matter of fact, I was in high school, and when I was in high school, I was a junior in an English class, and the teacher put out the list of books that we were supposed to read. And so I got the next book that I was supposed to read for English class and opened it up and was reading it. And I remember reading the first page, and from the very first page, it clearly was not a book that was consistent with what I thought God cared about or the values that God cared about. I couldn't imagine myself sitting next to Jesus and sharing with him this particular book. I thought he would say to me, you know, you probably shouldn't be reading that. And I remember trying to figure out to myself, what am I going to do? Because I don't feel like I should be reading this, but I'm supposed to read it because that's what my teacher told me to do. And particularly back then, was very much a go-with-the-flow kind of person. And so I really wrestled with it. And I remember the day that I decided I was going to talk to my English teacher. And I decided I was going to talk to him at the end of class. And so the whole time class is happening, I don't think I paid attention to anything because, honestly, I was pretty anxious about talking to him. And so I went up to his desk as everybody else is filing out of class. And I said, his name was Mr. Feeney. And I said, Mr. Feeney, can I talk to you? And he said, sure, what's up, Josh? And I said, you know, this is the next book we're supposed to read. I was trying to get a little bit of a jump on it. And so I started reading it. And I got to be honest, like I felt a little uncomfortable reading it. I just didn't feel it was appropriate for me to read. I said, I'm not telling you how you should teach the class. I'm not trying to tell you what everybody else should do. I just wondered, is there any way that I could get some kind of alternate book to read since I just didn't feel like it was appropriate for me to read this one? He paused and he looked at me for a moment and he said, sure, no problem. Give me a day or two to think about it and I'll come up with an alternate and you can read that. That's great. Thanks for being honest. Thanks for telling me. Glad you talked to me. And over the next couple of days, I waited for him to announce what the book was going to be to me, and he didn't get back to me. So about a week later, I went up to him after class again, and I said, hey, Mr. Feeney, just want to check in. I know we're like really close. That's supposed to be the next book we're going to read, and I just want to find out what you want me to read instead. And he said, you know, after we talked, I felt like maybe you probably weren't the only student who felt that way, and I didn't want to make any of the students uncomfortable, and so I've actually changed what we're going to do next. We're going to do a different book. And so my one request to get to do something different for myself actually changed what the entire class was going to be doing. And I thought that was pretty cool, but mostly I was just glad that I had been willing to take the risk because it was very hard for me. That felt like a big risk. And it's funny looking back on it, having had to take bigger risks since then, it doesn't feel like a big risk anymore, but it sure did at the time. And that's part of what we want to talk about today. The risk we're going to talk about today is a risk that three friends made in the book of Daniel in chapter 3. Daniel chapter 3. And I'd encourage you, if you haven't read it, to go back and read Daniel chapter 3. It's a great story. I'm not going to be able to read the whole thing to you, but I do want to set the story up. These three friends, their names were Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And at the point the story happens, they are actually officials or leaders of some kind in the nation of Babylon. And the nation of Babylon is ruled by a king who really functions as an emperor. It is his rule. What he says is the law. There is no court to appeal to. There is nobody else besides him. Whatever he says, that's the rules. It doesn't matter. And you have to do exactly what he says all of the time. And if you don't, he gets to decide what the consequences are all of the time. And so this particular time, he decides that he wants everybody to worship him. And so he makes a giant statue of himself. And he puts it up in the middle of a giant field. And he gathers all the leaders in the empire together. And he says to them, hey, we're going to play some music. And when the music starts, it is your job to bow down to the statue of me. Everybody. And so the music starts. And all of a sudden, everybody bows down. And I picture that moment, because it's got to have been a pretty profound moment when literally everybody that the eye can see kneels down and puts their head to the ground all at the same time. They're all bowing down together. And I can imagine the king looking out over all of these people bowing to the statue of him. And then he finds out that three people didn't bow down. And I imagine it must have been complicated for them in that moment, because they're not just three guys. They've got a lot on the line. They used to be penniless slaves, and they have risen all the way to this place of comfort, this place of influence, this place of authority in the empire. And there's a lot of peer pressure in that moment, right? Like, everybody's dropping down to their knees and dropping down to bow down. And it must have been a fascinating moment when everybody around them was bowing, but the three guys themselves were just standing there awkwardly in the middle of everybody else bowing down. And apparently the king himself doesn't notice, but somebody else finds out and says to the king, hey, these three guys, they didn't bow down. What's that all about? And so the king brings them back to him and says to them, hey, your job was to bow down when I told you to. If you don't, I'm going to kill you. And he actually says he's going to throw them in a fiery furnace. So there was a giant furnace there, and it must have been used for burning trash or cooking or whatever it was used for. It would have been giant. And the threat was, bow down to the statue of me, or I will throw you in the furnace live. I'll burn you to death. And my favorite part of the story, I don't know if you ever get one part of a story that you remember more than others, or one part of a story that really captures you more than others. I almost every movie I watch, there are always particular parts that I love more than any other part. So for example, years and years ago, I had to watch the autobiography of Malcolm X, and I don't remember almost anything else about that movie, but there's this one scene that I remember, and it's a scene where one of his guys is being taken to a hospital, and initially he's just taken to the police station. He's not given the care that he should, and Malcolm X goes to the police station and says, hey, I want you to, you need to take care of this guy and bring him to the hospital. And the police officer is a bit of a jerk and says, well, I'm not gonna. And how can you make me? And Malcolm says, why don't you just look out the window? And there is this giant, like a legion of men standing there waiting for Malcolm X to tell them what to do. And whatever Malcolm X says to do, that's what they're gonna do. And there's this amazing moment when finally the police bring out the man in an ambulance. And Malcolm, they're shouting and screaming, and Malcolm X just holds up his hand, and there is silence. And he turns his hand to the side and points to the left. And everybody turns, and in an orderly fashion begins to march after the ambulance. And I was always caught by that moment and the profound influence that it speaks to, because even back then I longed for influence, and I thought to myself, wow, that is somebody who had a lot of influence. But whatever your favorite movie is, whatever your favorite book is, whatever your favorite story is, there's probably moments that you remember. And for me, this particular moment in this particular story is one of the moments I've remembered for years and years and years. My first experience of the Book of Daniel was years ago. I remember when I grew up, I went to a church where there were no kids programs during the service except for nursery. So by the time I was 4 years old, I had to sit through the adult service, and it wasn't pretty because I don't sit still well now. At 4 years old, I definitely didn't sit still. And I remember by the time I was 10 or 11, all I had to keep me occupied was my Bible, and I'd figured out the parts of the Bible that were the most exciting, and I read those over and over and over again. And one of the parts of the Bible that was the most exciting to me was this particular story about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And particularly this moment when the king, whose name was Nebuchadnezzar, flies into a rage and orders that these three men be brought to him, and he commands them to bow down to him or they're going to be thrown in the fire. And their answer is so amazing to me, and it's captured in verses 16 through 18 of Daniel chapter 3. And this is what it says. It says, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God whom we serve is able to save us. He will rescue us from your power, your majesty. But even if he doesn't, we want to make it clear to you, your majesty, that we will never serve your gods or worship the golden statue that you have set up. That is all they say. And there's a couple of things I think are powerful about this. First of all, I think it's powerful that this is not the first story we have about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego taking a risk because of their relationship with God. You know, have you ever wondered how God will reward you for taking a risk? Sometimes we expect God to make things easier or to fix our situations or fix our problems. And this story gives us a fascinating insight into exactly how God rewards risk takers. And get ready for this, because this is not what you'd expect. Back in chapter 1 of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and their friend Daniel decide to take a risk. And the risk is this. They are brought in to be mentored and trained to be leaders in the civil service, in the government. And so they are given very specific foods that they're supposed to eat, a very specific way that they're supposed to live, a specific training program. The government takes over every aspect of their lives in order to train them to become the leaders that the government wants them to be. And part of that is that they're required to eat foods and drink drinks that, according to their religious beliefs, they weren't supposed to eat or drink. It was all these foods that had been sacrificed to idols, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and their friend Daniel didn't believe it was appropriate for them to eat food that was sacrificed to idols. And so they went to the man in charge of the training and said to him, look, here's the thing. We don't think it's appropriate for us to eat that. Is there any way you can just give us, just as a test for, I think it was 14 days or 21 days or whatever it was, can you just give us plain water and vegetables for a couple of weeks? And then you test us to see if it's harmed us. If it's harmed us in any way, if somehow we're underperforming because of this, then we will go back to eating what you want us to eat. But if we're not underperforming, we want to keep eating that instead of all the fancy food that you're bringing us. This was a pretty giant risk. They had been slaves up to this point. Their entire nation had been taken captive and brought into exile in Babylon. They were all from Israel. And so their lives were functionally useless, and this was their one opportunity to get ahead in life, and they put that opportunity at risk by saying to the man in charge, we don't want to do what you want us to do. Instead, we want to do it this other way. And it turned out the man let them try it, and it turned out that it actually worked out really, really well. They ended up being the fastest, the smartest, the most competent, the most capable people in the entire group of people that were being trained around them. And so their risk worked out, and it proved them, and actually ended up being giving them an opportunity to advance beyond all the people around them. But what's amazing to me about that story is that they took a little risk in chapter 1, and in chapter 3, they get the blessing that you receive when you take a little risk. And you know what that blessing is? The opportunity to take a bigger risk. People who take little risks for Jesus eventually are blessed with the opportunity to take big risks. And I know that's a funny thing, because sometimes we want God to make it easier or more comfortable or more more simple for us. But, you know, it is not God's goal in life to make our lives easy. It's not God's goal in life to make our lives simple or comfortable. It is God's goal in life to form our character to be like that of Jesus Christ, to help us to become the best men and women that we could possibly be, to become everything God envisions us being able to be. And you don't become those things by being comfortable. You don't grow by being comfortable. As a matter of fact, we were just at a conference as a staff all together a couple of weeks ago, and we heard one of the speakers, his name was Rasmussen Ankerson. He talked about this story about the training ground where some of the world's greatest sprinters are trained. And he went down there because it turned out that a whole bunch of the world's greatest sprinters were all from not just the same country, not just the same city, but they're all trained in this one single training facility. And so we wanted to find out, man, what are they doing to make these guys such amazing runners? And so he goes down there and he expects to see some like multi-million dollar building that's fancy and expensive and has all the latest technology and all of this stuff. And he gets down there and he sees a chain link fence essentially around a dirt field. And that's it. And just before light, he sees an old man walk up with a folding chair. And he puts the folding chair down, pulls out a whistle, and he waits. And slowly, a group of runners come in. And he starts them running, and has them running hour after hour, and they're working incredibly hard. And towards the end of the day, Rasmussen goes up to the trainer and says, "You know, I came here expecting a great facility. I came here expecting high tech stuff, and all I saw was this dirty field. Like, how is it that in such a low tech facility, you can out train men and women who train in million-dollar facilities?" And the man said something I thought was profound. He said, "You know, I think you have to make a decision as a trainer whether or not you want people to be comfortable or you want them to grow. Do you want people to be comfortable or do you want them to grow?" He said, the trainer said, "You know, I look at some of those American gyms you guys have, and it looks pretty much like you want people to come in and be comfortable. And if that's the goal, to make people come in and be comfortable, they're not going to be very good runners, because becoming a better runner isn't comfortable. And if you train people to be comfortable, they just won't get that much better." He said, "I have no interest in training people to be comfortable. I have interest in training the best runners in the world. So I don't care if they're comfortable. I don't care if it's convenient, and I don't care if it's easy. It's my job to make great runners, not to make comfortable people." I thought that was amazing. And I thought he captured something profound about growth. Growth and comfort are never consistent with one another. You can't be comfortable and grow. And so when we want to grow, God starts us off by inviting us to take a little risk, and then he honors us for it. And then when that little risk is successful, he invites us to take a bigger risk, because he knows that bigger risk is going to change us even more, transform our character, transform who we are, reform who we are in a deeper and more profound way. And so he rewards little risks with the opportunity to take greater risks. That's the first thing I want you to notice in this story. The second thing I want you to notice in this story is that the power of a single word here. Did you catch the word "if" in what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said? They said, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, the God whom we serve is able to save us. He will rescue us from your power, your majesty. But even if he doesn't, we want to make it clear to you, your majesty, we will never serve your gods or worship the golden statue you have set up." That second "if" is so powerful. You see, these men knew who God was. And they had experience to prove it. This was the God who had gotten them out of having to eat that food that time. This was the God who had kept them safe even when their entire country was ransacked. This was the God who had taken care of them and loved them even when their entire world was turned upside down. They knew who God was, and they knew that God was able to rescue because they had seen God be a rescuer. And not only that, but they had the stories of their entire nation's history way back. God had rescued his people from Egypt miraculously, and he had told his people the 1,000 years before that, before when he rescued them from Egypt, he'd said, make sure you remember this. And he told them that because he wanted them to remember what kind of God he was. He is a rescuing God. No matter what you think, no matter what your experience today is, God has 1,000-year history of rescuing people. That's what he wanted Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego to know, and he wants you to know the same thing. He wants you to know that God has a history of rescuing people. He has been rescuing people for thousands and thousands of years. So whatever your experience today is, no matter what you think is happening in your life in this moment, no matter whether or not you think God is active or inactive or loud or quiet, it does not matter, because God has been proving himself to be a rescuing God for thousands and thousands of years. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego knew who God was. They knew he was a rescuing God, and so they said with great confidence, God's going to rescue us, that's fine. But they also knew, they knew they couldn't control God. They knew that they couldn't force God, and they knew, no matter how confident they were in God's character, that maybe they misunderstood God's plan. And they didn't wait for 100% confidence. Faith is not always 100% confidence. Faith is confidence that you know who God is and how he is most likely to act. And they knew who God was, and they were confident in how God was most likely going to act. But despite all of that, they knew there was an if. If he doesn't, that's the risk. What if I do something for God and he doesn't make my life easier? What if I do something for God? What if I take a risk and God doesn't miraculously save me? What if I do something for God and somehow life gets more complicated? And I'll be honest, I've seen this happen. I've seen it get complicated when people take risks for God. And the profound thing is that these men declare, no matter what, we are confident in what the right thing is. You see, this is the difference. They didn't need to know what God would do. They just needed to know what they were choosing to do. Their choice was not dependent on anything else. They knew the right thing to do, and they were committed to doing it, and they were trusting that whatever God did after that, it would be for the best. It would be the wisest course of action. They knew God loved them. They knew God was able to rescue them. They knew God was a consistent rescuer. They knew that God could act and that God would act in the best way possible, and that was up to God. They didn't need to worry themselves about what God was or was not going to do. They didn't need to concern themselves with God's future action. They only concerned themselves with their present action. Not what is God going to do, but what am I doing right now? That was what concerned them. And this is a really important lesson for us. So often we worry about contingencies. What might happen in this situation? What'll happen if this happens? How do I decide what's going to happen if this happens or that happens? How is God going to act? How are they going to act? How is she going to act? How is he going to act? We get so lost in the potential options of what might happen in the future, we lose the fact that the only thing we have control over is our actions right here, right now. And these three men knew that. They knew that the only control they had, the only influence they had, the only power they had was in the present moment. And it was only over themselves. And so they were committed to taking the risk no matter what. You know, I do a lot of funerals, and so often the funerals that I'm a part of, that I lead, they are for folks who have passed away before their time. And in many of those circumstances, I find myself saying to people that it's okay to wonder why. It's okay to wonder what God's doing. It's okay to have questions. Because so often people come into those moments wanting to ask God that exact question. God, what are you doing? What is going on here? I don't understand. And God welcomes those questions. But he doesn't give very simple answers. And in this moment, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego could have gotten lost in the questions. And this is important. While it is okay to ask questions, while God welcomes our questions and our confusion, he does not consider confusion or questions an excuse for inaction. God welcomes our questions, he welcomes our confusion, but he does not consider them to be an excuse for inaction. Do you see the difference? It's perfectly okay for these young men to have wondered whether or not God was going to act. It was perfectly okay for them to be confidently saying God is going to act and still saying, well, if he doesn't. I find myself in these situations when I'm praying all the time. I remember the first time I prayed for someone to be healed. I remember the last time I prayed for someone to be healed, which was just a day or two ago. Matter of fact, it was just this morning. I was typing a prayer via text to somebody asking God to heal them. And I find my prayers having a similar kind of language to this. I say, God, I know you're a healer. I know you're able to heal. I know that you're powerful enough to heal. I am asking you to heal in this situation. Heal this person right now. And God, if you do not, then I ask you to bring them comfort and give wisdom to the doctors and help them to get through this situation. And I'll be honest, I wrestled for a long time. I wondered, am I lacking faith by adding that if you do not stuff? Is that me saying, well, God, I don't really think you're going to heal? And I don't think it is. Sometimes maybe it is for some of us, but I don't think it always is. I'm just acknowledging, I don't know what you're going to do. God, I know you're able to heal. God, I'm confident you can heal. And I think this is that kind of moment where these men are saying, I'm confident God can rescue us miraculously. I'm confident God is able to do the miraculous in our lives right here, right now. But even if he doesn't, I'm going to do the right thing. That is amazing to me. And that is what God they do in this moment. And so I want to kind of wrap up today by asking you these questions. What is a situation in which you can take a risk? What is a situation in which you can take a risk this week? A risk for your relationship with God. I also want to ask you, what if God doesn't make it okay? Will you still have been glad to take the risk? What if God doesn't fix it when things get complicated? Is it still okay that you took the risk? Whatever the situation is in your life, are you confident that you know who God is? That God is a healer? That God is a miracle worker? That God is a rescuer and a redeemer? Are you confident of who God is, even if you are not confident of what God is going to do in your situation? What is it about God that you need to keep in the front of your mind as you prepare yourself to take a risk in whatever situation you need to take a risk in? So with that in mind, we're going to get really practical here and break up into our small groups so you have an opportunity to really think about this. So God bless, enjoy the rest of your week, and have a great discussion.